Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Strike one, line drive, base hit into center. J.D. Martinez in. Right behind him, Justin Upton, third of the plate, will be cut off. He will score. Maven's trapped between first and second. He'll be caught in the rundown eventually. Two-run score, and the Tigers take a two-run lead. 2-1, swinging a fly ball, right field off the bat of Eric Ibar, way back in right, and wow. Gone. How about that? Swings and drives this one to right field. Oh, man, watch it fly. Gone. Victor Martinez with an absolute no-doubter to right. Tigers are having some fun. Ground ball to short. Ibar charges. Fields throws on the run to get Max Kepler easily at first. Another good inning for Kyle Ryan, and the Tigers take the opener here in Minneapolis.
I think I'm still living level up. That's what happened tonight, but that doesn't gonna stop me. I just gotta keep working, you know, and I know I could have done. I don't know, but I'll try to get it as soon as I can, you know. I'm working. I'm gonna keep working every day, every single day. It is tough, you know, like right now we're trying to win. And like I said, we just can't let that get into our minds, you know, and just go out there and attack like we always do.
With too many fastballs, you know, because of that, it didn't seem like they really had to respect his off-speed pitches. So they got pretty good swings his fastball. You know, the hope is that he gets some repetition, you know, including side days and stuff, and you know, gets back to the Danny that we saw in the first half, because it'll certainly be helpful.
Six Notre Dame players were arrested in two separate incidents. South Bend officers arrested cornerback Devin Butler outside of a bar. After shoving a woman, he allegedly tackled an officer and was arrested. And in another incident, five Notre Dame players were pulled over with marijuana and a loaded handgun in the car. The University of Notre Dame issued a statement this morning saying, quote, any student arrested on a felony charge also faces dismissal from the university. The university will determine if additional sanctions should apply to any or all of the students charged.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding Wednesday. And we appreciate you being a part of our program this afternoon. We've got 2 hours of outstanding awesomeness in store for you. And if you're wondering what we're talking about today, you just heard quite a bit of it. Got a great taste of it anyway. Highlights from the Tigers' win, lowlights, at least in terms of commentary, from the Indians' loss, Danny Salazar, Terry Francona. The Indians lost to Oakland in Salazar's second straight clunker after coming off of the DL. Drops that 7.5-game lead that the Indians had over the Tigers, obviously down to 6.5 now. So we're going to talk a little bit about that coming up with Dennis Mantiloff at about 3:35. Then you heard a little bit of the news report from over the weekend, and we haven't spent a lot of time on this. The news report about the various transgressions of Notre Dame football players, and that report detailed two different situations that led to at least one player being kicked off the team, others being suspended and dealt with in-house. Brian Kelly, the head coach at Notre Dame, dropping some very, very heavy language on the individuals involved, pulled no punches whatsoever, and declared their behavior to be absolutely unacceptable, and they are going to be certainly deserving of all of their punishments. Brendan Riley, who writes for and actually edits, I believe, right, Jim Cushlin?
Yes, that's right.
Of 18stripes.com, which is a Notre Dame football and Notre Dame sports fan site. He'll join us at 4:05 to talk a little bit about that. Did I miss anything? What else is in that montage, or did we get it all?
No, you got it all.
Good stuff there. And there's a lot of other things to get into. Breaking news on the Joey Bosa story from early this afternoon. I don't know if you saw this or not. The former Buckeye All-American, number 3 overall pick in this past April's NFL draft, has still not reported to practice to camp with the San Diego Chargers. The only holdout in the first round. I don't know, Jim, he might be the only holdout in all of the draft. I don't know if there's anybody who is remaining unsigned at this point in time.
Yeah, I can look that up, but I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. How many guys in the second or third round are going to consider themselves to be so, what's the word? What's the opposite of expendable? Indispensable, maybe. So indispensable that they're willing to hold out for a bigger contract or a better contract on their way into their first mini camp or their first training camp, I should say. Generally speaking, it is first rounders who do this sort of thing. So Joey Bosa is still out and apparently no closer to playing than he was before he was even drafted, meaning that San Diego has issued a statement essentially saying he's not going to play this full season. There's no way they would have him ready by game one. That's not going to happen. And that means he starts losing game checks, by the way, if he is not signed by that time. Here's what the Chargers said. They released the following statement just about 3 hours ago. So like I said, early afternoon, 3 hours ago, this statement regarding the contract negotiations with first-round pick Joey Bosa, quote, "Our contract discussions and offers to the representatives of Joey Bosa have been both fair and structurally consistent with the contracts of every other Chargers player. Our offer included, one, an initial signing bonus payment that is larger than any player in the league. Well, they worded that a little bit awkwardly. It says, larger than any player in the league has received in the last two drafts. I don't think they needed a couple of those words. Anyway, signing bonus larger than any player in the league, well, I guess I get it now, has received in the last two drafts. So this year and in the 2015 draft, nobody has gotten a bigger bonus than what Joey Bosa would be getting. Two, more money in this calendar year than every player in this year's draft except one, and that is quarterback Carson Wentz. Three, the largest payment and the highest percentage of signing bonus received in the first calendar year of any Chargers first-round selection since the inception of the current collective bargaining agreement in 2011. It goes on to say, we gave Joey's representatives our best offer last night, which was rejected today. That offer that we extended was for Joey to contribute during all 16 games and beyond. Joey's ability to contribute for an entire rookie season has now been jeopardized by the valuable time he has missed with his coaches and his teammates. Since Joey will not report at this time, his ability to produce not just early in the season, but throughout the entire season, has been negatively impacted. As a result, we will restructure our offer since Joey will be unable to contribute for the full 16-game season without the adequate time on the practice field, in the classroom, and in preseason games. End quote. So dropping the hammer down are the San Diego Chargers, basically saying we made our best offer last night. It was rejected today. So when they say we will restructure our offer, you know what that means. They're going to drop the offer. Rather than increase the offer to get Bosa to sign, it will now be less. It will be less in terms of signing bonus. It will be less in terms of guaranteed money in the first year. It will be less in terms of guaranteed money overall because, in their belief, he will not be able to contribute at the level we had hoped the number three overall pick in the draft would be able to contribute since he won't be able to prepare for the season. And since his production will be less than the expected amount would be, then the compensation is going to be less than what the expected amount or what the originally offered amount would be. So the Chargers are playing hardball and putting this entirely on Joey Bosa and his representatives. Cushlin, what do you think?
Well, what I think is, the first and foremost, the San Diego Chargers have already been down this kind of road with the whole Eli Manning, Phillips River.
Yeah. They live on this street. That's where their house is built.
Right. And, you know, I can't really blame them at this point. I mean, you know, you draft a guy. And we brought this up before in this with this issue that he had never demanded the kind of things that Eli Manning, for example, did, and that's why that became an easier trade at the time.
Yeah.
And Bosa never really did that, and that's why the Chargers have been somewhat.
And Bosa could have done that.
Sure.
Bosa could have made it very clear the way Manning did through his father Archie, by the way, who had some connections, obviously, with the Chargers. So it was easier since he's more well known in the league. And I don't know what the representatives for Bosa did, but he could have very well said, look, this is what I'm looking for in my first contract. This is what I want in my rookie contract. And anybody not willing to give me that, please don't select me. And if they would have talked to the representatives of San Diego and said, hey, what are your chances or what are your thought processes? Where is Joey Bosa on your board? Is this somebody you would consider? Because if so, here are his demands or his wish list, if you will. And if you can't meet this, he's not going to be reporting. And you might as well just go ahead and either not take him or take him and make a draft day trade with somebody else who wants him, who will be willing to do this. And so that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. And Bosa did not, apparently, according to all the reports that I've read, Bosa did not make this clear before the draft.
Right.
So he went into this with he and his representatives. I don't know how much of this is Joey Bosa, the Ohio State All-American, and how much of this is just, hey, to his representatives, hey, this is what we can get for you, and let's not back down. Stick with us here. Because we don't know sometimes who's driving the bus in some of these negotiations for the player. Is it the player telling the representatives, this is what I want, make it happen? Or is it the representatives who are paid a healthy chunk of that salary, roughly 4% of those contract values? Is it them advising him, hey, Joey, look, this is the best way to go for you. We're gonna get this for you, that for you, and this for you. Just trust us. Don't panic. Don't worry about missing camp. Just trust us and let us do this for you. And I don't know. I don't know who's leading the charge here or who's driving the bus. But either way, this looks like a traffic accident on that road you're talking about.
Right.
This is a bus colliding with a train, so therefore we can call it an official train wreck. The Chargers do not want to give Joey Bosa what he wants. Joey Bosa does not want to perform and will not be able to, according to the Chargers, at the level that they think he could without getting what he wants. According to, now I'm reading a very interesting piece from today's Pigskin, which is kind of a fan site, but it's pretty interesting, and it's headlined, "The Chargers' attempt to embarrass Bosa publicly will only backfire." I will say this, it worked, because I'm embarrassed for him. I think it makes him look terrible, what the Chargers just pointed out. The Chargers just said that the former Buckeye All-American is going to get more money in signing bonus than anybody in the league in the last two drafts has gotten. He's going to get more money in this calendar year than anybody except for one player, quarterback Carson Wentz. By the way, didn't he go 2 overall?
Yes.
Then I wonder how come he got more this year than Jared Goff did, which is interesting, who was number 1 overall.
Yeah, because usually the scale goes by where you're picked. So.
Yeah, but then again, that just might be the way it's structured, not the overall value. We know that Goff got the overall higher value contract, but in this particular year, year 1, which is what they pointed out.
Right.
And then the Chargers said that Bosa would receive the largest payment and the highest percentage of signing bonus received in the first calendar year of any Chargers first round pick since the collective bargaining agreement was struck back in 2011. Now, according to this site that I just mentioned, breaking it down, the Chargers have made all those claims, but they don't really address the bare bones of what the disagreement has been all along for Joey Bosa. Bosa wanted none of his signing bonus deferred to next year. And he didn't want any offset language in his contract. So, in other words, that's one of the points of contention. The Chargers are saying, we only deferred a little. He's still getting more this year than anybody else in the draft except for Wentz. That's one thing. Bosa's people are saying, that's not what we want. We want all of it this year. None of it should be deferred at all. That's his, I don't know why, but that's his argument. That's what he said he wants in this negotiation. The Chargers don't address that in the statement, how much of the bonus they want to defer, and they don't address the issue of offset language at all. If you're Bosa, you have to sit there and wonder why any of your bonus should be deferred at all. To him, it doesn't matter what past Charger draftees have received. It matters what other NFL high draft picks have received. And 16, according to this particular site, 16 of the last 20 top 5 picks, 16 of the last 20 picks taken in the top 5. Let's make sure we understand that. So that would be the last 4 years of top 5 picks. 16 of them have not had to deal with either bonus deferral or offset language in their contract. So Bosa may feel like we're being picked or he's being picked on here in a way that 16 of the last 20, and if my count is right, that's 80%, 4 out of 5 of the last 5 top 5 draft picks in the last 4 classes have not had to lose any of their money, not lose it, but have it deferred to the second year or any offset language. The Chargers have made it a habit to get both of those things since the CBA went into place, and they are the outlier, not the norm. They've benefited from the fact that none of their previous first-rounders have fought for those things. Bosa isn't asking for the moon. He simply wants things that the high draft picks from other teams have gotten, like real NFL teams that operate professionally. There's an editorial comment there, of course, against the Chargers, which is fine. But then we know that Alex Spanos and his team struggle to operate professionally at times, with Wednesday's statement being Exhibit A. What do they think they're going to accomplish with this statement? An obvious spin job to make Bosa look greedy. Well, I'm going to say this. In my mind, he does look greedy. And I'm going to say this, and I'm not trying to knock a Buckeye, obviously. I don't want to do that, but in my mind, it doesn't just look greedy, it is greedy. If this money is guaranteed, and we are talking about signing bonuses, and signing bonuses, generally speaking, are always guaranteed. The total value of contracts are not guaranteed. We always talk about this in baseball and in basketball, the NFL and MLB. Contracts are guaranteed because the physical nature of the game of football is just different. They can't guarantee contracts when guys could have their careers ended with one hit to the knee in the wrong way. They just can't do that. But signing bonuses are among the guaranteed dollars. So if those dollars are guaranteed, I don't know what percentage they're talking about deferring to year two, but what's the difference? He's going to get it. It's guaranteed, whether he gets it all right now in his first one lump sum or gets most of it now, and in fact, according to the Chargers, more than anybody else has ever gotten in a Chargers uniform and more than anybody else in this particular year except for Carson Wentz. He's going to get more than all of that anyway this year, and then he's going to get some of that signing bonus next year as well. I don't know what percentage it is the big deal, but in my mind, Joey Bosa needs to go play football. This holding out over when you're getting the money, not even an amount of money, not even talking about the total value of the contract, which according to this site and other reports that I've read, isn't the issue. It's not about total dollars. It's not about total guaranteed money or number of years. It's a rookie deal. It's just simply about when he gets some of his money. And that, to me, is not a reason to be holding out. If anybody had a reason to hold out, it would be somebody who's going to be vastly underpaid compared to the other high picks, either in A, their draft, or B, previous drafts at the same slot. Now, that also can, you know, have a little bit of a, how do we want to say that? It can be very, it can be varied, V-A-R-I-E-D, instead of vary. It can vary because of position. You know, if a quarterback is taking number three overall, then his value is going to probably be a little bit higher than the number three overall to pick who, in one year, who might be a defensive end like Joey Bosa. So outside of that, if that's not his problem, why isn't he in there practicing with his team and trying to go out there and win the AFC West? The Chargers have tried to embarrass him. There's no doubt about that. Bosa has made it clear that this is, an issue of respect. He feels disrespected by this whole thing. His mother even went to the press and said she wished they had forced a trade on draft day like Eli Manning. You remember that from a few days ago, Jim. We quoted that.
Oh, yeah.
And the Chargers have talked about how they think they can contend this season, and it would be with Joey Bosa there, but having all of his playing time and all of his practice time, et cetera. And since he's not getting his practice time, his classroom time, and his preseason time, they don't think he's going to be as effective, not just to start, but for the full 16 games, because he's going to have that learning curve he may never catch up to. And now they're going to drop the offer. And once they drop the offer, and when I say drop it, I don't mean eliminate it. Once they lower the offer, watch and see what that does to contract negotiations with the former Ohio State Buckeye All-American Cush.
And I think a lot of this is probably legitimate speculation because of the way this has been handled on all the various sides. And therefore, on that note, I think one of the elephants in the room on this whole thing, and this was kind of brought up real soon after the draft, and you referenced what Bosa's mother said to the press, and I, because you asked a few minutes ago, is this his representatives? Is this Bosa? I think a lot of the minutia, numbers, and things we're talking about is coming from his reps, but it leaves open speculation such as this. Joey Bosa simply does not want to play for the San Diego Chargers. You know, they haven't been run well in recent years, and then of course you have all the, are they going to move to Vegas or the other LA real soon hanging over the head? Maybe,
but
part of this
that would affect his decision to hold out.
Darn
or,
right
or
it would.
Report?
Darn right it would.
Why?
Because he doesn't want to play for him.
But what does he care if it's in Vegas or in San Diego? What does he? I mean, there's a whole roster of guys right now in San Diego who don't know where they're going to play
either, but
they do know that they're going to be extraordinarily well compensated to play wherever it is.
And you having asked that question is on Joey Bosa for not more or less saying, I don't want to play for the Chargers, thus opening up this whole can. And because they could talk.
But is
this,
that the case, though?
I absolutely think it's part of it. Yes.
I don't even know if that is the case, other than I would be fine to play for the Chargers if they weren't doing this to me right now. So you're saying that if they had come to him and said, hey, you know what? We're going to give you everything that you want here. We're going to give you the same contract deal we offered you before, but we won't defer any of the money. You'll get all up front this year as far as the signing bonus and no offset language, and it's all good to go. You're saying he would still find a reason to not report just because he doesn't want to play for these guys?
I think, sadly, that's possible because of the way this whole episode has been handled so far. It opens up that possible speculation. And it wouldn't be the first time a player has, over the course of history, said, I don't want to play for you. You referenced the Eli Manning thing. We all remember John Elway back in the day basically saying, I'll play baseball instead of playing for the Baltimore Colts.
For the Baltimore Colts, that's
and
right.
Because this has been, to me at least, and I'm speculating here, don't get me wrong, but the way this has been handled on all sides, yeah, one has to verbalize that question. Does he simply not want to play for this team and organization in general?
Yeah, I would love to hear a statement from Joey Bosa's agents and his representatives. I want to hear what's going on. Why did you turn down the best offer that was made last night? That best offer was made last night, rejected today, and then pulled immediately after the rejection. It is no law. You can't change your mind now and say, okay, we'll take it. The Chargers are saying, we gave you all of these things. You're going to get more money this year than anybody else in the draft, except for Carson Wentz, even more than the top pick Jared Goff is going to get this year, and he's a quarterback, for goodness sakes. You're going to get all of this stuff that you wanted, except for the offset language and a couple of dollars deferred to next year, and I don't know what the amount is. I want to hear from the agents. I want to know, is this Joey's stand? Is it because he doesn't want to play there? Jim, usually if that's the case, they'll say it. Usually that will be announced. And whether the agents say it or they leak it to somebody else who will say it, that Bosa just doesn't like the Chargers organization and this is not his thing. A la Eli Manning, a la John Elway, like you pointed out, if he just didn't want to go there, it needs to be said.
Yes,
I think this is a straight. I think this is a straight-up greed play. I don't know why, because, according to all of the information we have, this is going to be the same amount. The dollar figure, the total compensation package isn't going to change. It's just a matter of how it's portioned out. Some this year, some next year, or all this year, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this looks really, really bad for Joey Bosa. I think it looks bad for his agents, his representatives. And I really think they need to come out here and say something because he's taken a public beating on this. It is now a PR war. And even though a lot of people in the press don't like the Chargers for previous situations, they are winning this PR war. Everything I read in that statement makes Joey Bosa look really, really bad right now.
Right down to the part where
I wonder what it's doing to his teammates, too, by the way. I wonder how they're going to feel about him once he finally does come in, if that happens.
And you're talking about some of the things the Chargers said. Right down to how this would affect them on the field. I mean, let's think of where we are in the calendar, whether it's tomorrow or Friday or Saturday, whenever your team plays, for example, Lions Saturday, Browns Friday. This is preseason week number 3, the so-called dress rehearsal game. A guy like Bosa, had everything been normal, he would have gotten a ton of reps in this game, or may not have even played in the next one. So he is vastly behind, considering he's a rookie. And because of all this, we know he didn't go to the OTAs or anything. And then there's this part of it, too. I do think that what you're saying about the money and these factors is probably the prominent thing. But because this is so messed up on all sides here, I feel that other question about does he even want to play for that team has to be, it can be brought up because we don't know.
But I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to stand by it. I think if that was the case, it would already have been said.
I'd like to think that, but clearly people have been messing this up since day one.
Even if not by him, Jim, or like by his dad, just in the Archie Manning example, or by his agent, somebody would have leaked it so that everybody gets the word here. We want the Chargers to know this isn't just about money. He doesn't want to play for your franchise. Do something. The time to trade Joey Bosa after picking him wasn't now. It was on draft day.
Yep.
The time was on draft day or very shortly after it. Not now, as teams are setting rosters, for God's sake, getting ready for the third dress rehearsal preseason game. All right, let's get out. I'm going to ask Dennis Mandeloff about this and more. We're going to talk also about the Josh Gordon rumor we talked about yesterday, the situation in Cleveland now, at least I shouldn't say situation, the accusation from some at least according to Pro Football Talk, is that the Browns may have planted those trade rumors that teams were burning up the phone lines to talk about trading for Josh Gordon because the Browns wanted to spark an interest in him because maybe they are interested in such a thing. So we're going to get into that. Also, the American League Central race with Maniloff coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That is indeed what we call it right here on Toledo Sports Leader, 866-240-1065, the number to join us, 866-240-1065. We'll get back to the Joey Bosa conversation in just a bit. We do want to shift gears, though, and talk a little bit more about the American League Central race, which got just a little bit tighter last night as the Indians got pounded. Danny Salazar, more specifically, maybe a better way to say it, got pounded by the Oakland A's, and the Tigers did some pounding of their own of the Twins. So they knocked the deficit down to 6.5 games. It is a 7.5 game, the Indians lead, I should say, the Indians now have over the third-place Kansas City Royals, who won their 9th in a row. So talking AL Central race and more. Now with us is Dennis Maniloff, who is a sports writer extraordinaire for the Northeast Ohio Media Group and also the author of a tremendous book that I highly recommend called From A to Z, Andrew's Tzastadil. Dennis Maniloff, thanks for taking some time away from the ballgame this afternoon. How you doing?
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for having me. I've got it on DVR, so I'll be going to it right as soon as I'm done with your hit.
You know what's funny? I was just talking to Cushlin off the air, actually before the show, about this, about what you do.
What's going on?
What's that?
No, just something was going on to Dennis.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear either one of you guys. Sorry, I'm busy flapping my own gums here. But Dennis, I was just talking to Cushlin, and I said, yeah, Dennis is going to step away from the game for the first inning or so, depending on how long we talk, to chat with us about all this stuff. And Cush goes, yeah, well, it doesn't matter. It's not like he doesn't DVR them and watch every pitch. And I said, yeah, that's kind of his thing. It's what you do for the Northeast Ohio Media Group and Cleveland.com. You watch every pitch and break down almost every pitch that the starter throws, and I don't know if you do the same for the relievers every game, and you do the same thing, of course, for football. Every drop back, you're grading the quarterback on what happened, what the circumstances were, down in distance, and so on and so forth. And I kind of said that's his gig at the PD or Cleveland.com, and I was wondering, Dennis, is that your gig because it was an assignment you were given to break down every throw? Is this just kind of your idea and what you do, your idea and what you do?
Yeah, it just started in 2014 with the Indians, D-Man's game report, and I began with the opening day in 2014 and just, tried to give a unique perspective on the game. And I felt like I needed to watch the game because of the value of replays. That was the key. Because I needed to be able to rewind stuff. So 2014 was good with the Indians. And then, I had been doing – well, actually, it did start with the quarterback reports before that, right? So the quarterback –
I thought I remember that because, grading every pass Brady Quinn throws, grading every – and I don't know if you did it as far back as Brady Quinn – grading every pass that Brandon Whedon throws, et cetera, et cetera. And every drop back, in fact, even if he doesn't get a throw up.
It really started with Whedon, yeah. I wanted to see how Whedon did. So we did the QB reports. They were well-received. I got enough people saying, well, why don't you try it with baseball? So we did baseball starting in 14. Then the Cavs, I've done the last two seasons of the Cavs every game. It's not like you write about every single pitch or write about every single possession, but you try to chart as much as you can and then digest the information and then give it to the reader in a condensed form. And hopefully you're taking them, somewhere where they hadn't necessarily seen it. They might have missed something, if they were watching it live. I'm now kind of in a D-man's report mode with all three of the majors, and it becomes a year-round deal. But the one thing is, I haven't, God willing, I haven't missed any of the games of the three majors in Cleveland since I started doing this.
Dennis, I'm amazed by the fact that you do it for all three of the major sports, and I want to know when I think of a beat writer. Their time is basically pregame. They got to show up and do some interviews. If they're doing a little sidebar story or whatever, they got to talk to a player or two, and then they maybe have to go in and listen to the manager's pregame remarks. And then they watch the game, which is about 3 hours. And then they got to get a game report in. How long does it normally take? Because you've done gamers as well. How long before the deadline is after a game, a final out that you have to have your gamer in?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. When I was writing the Gamers and covering and being part of the coverage team with Hoynes on the Indians, you know, it would depend. But night games, you generally had, you know, a hard deadline, maybe, I don't know, 30 minutes after the game ended and, you know, accounting for a three-hour game. But then you had another deadline at midnight that you had to update for. So okay. Multiple deadlines for the newspaper that were hard deadlines.
The only reason I ask is their jobs are watch the game 3 hours and then get the gamer done. And you're doing something entirely different. How many more hours are you working per game than those guys? Because you're watching it on DVR, rewinding, play, rewinding, slow motion, chart, stat, plus three. Attempt not. You. How long does it take you to do one of these things, man?
Well, first of all, the beat guys and girls are the kings and queens. They're the ones that do all the hard work.
I know, but I'm just talking hours, though. I'm just talking straight man hours in what you're doing.
Well, I mean, it does. I hate to couch it again, but it does depend. You know, I mean, there's prep involved. I mean, I always watch the pregame shows to get a feel for what you know I'm going to see. I read up on what's happening with each team before they play, and the matchups and maybe something to look for. And then you watch the game and the rewinding and the DVR stuff can take anywhere from, you know, 10 minutes where you want to look at a couple extra pitches to, a couple of hours where you might want to look at an entire inning or in the case of, you know, the Browns, a drive or in the case of the Cats, you know, multiple possessions. So, really varies depending on the significance of the moment in the game or the significance of the game itself.
Okay, fair enough. It's just a great work because I really do like reading those summaries and condensed versions of all of the stuff that you do when you chart and then kind of give us the, you know, the encapsulated look at how things are and maybe even a letter grade. I just think it's very good. Now let's grade, and I think we already know what grade they're going to get for recent performances. I guess it's more a question of finding out what's wrong with two-fifths of the Indian starting rotation, which has been the best in the American League and one of the best in baseball. Josh Tomlin, and now last night, Danny Salazar, for the second time off of the DL, got pounded. He only lasted an inning in his first time out. He went further last night, but just is continuing to struggle. Is it still a matter of injury? Is he going back on the DL? What is wrong with Salazar? And then also, if you can figure out how Tomlin was so tough for the first half of the year and has been just so, I don't know, if it's too harsh to say brutal, really, for at least the last month or so.
Yeah, you cited why it's kind of uneasy around here because two-fifths of the rotation is in, I dare we say, dire straits at this point. You know, with Tomlin, it's been ineffectiveness. Really, there's no sense or hint of injury. But with Salazar, he obviously had some elbow discomfort that put him on, you know, on shutdown for, 17 days. Came back, and you know, his two starts since, he combined for five innings. The two starts before he was shut down combined for, I believe, six innings. So in his last four starts total, he's thrown 11 innings. I mean, you talk about a slump, 11 innings, 20 hits, 19 runs. So you just can't have that, especially from a guy who was named the All-Star team. Now, what is wrong with Salazar? He said he had discomfort. They checked him out. They claim nothing is structurally wrong. I think part of it could be that he is afraid to cut it loose because he feels like when he cuts it loose, he feels something. That's possible. He certainly didn't look injured last night against the A's. He was simply ineffective. The velocity is there, but the finish to his pitches is not there. He's not able to throw the fastball where he wants to. He's not getting it down. He's not throwing a third pitch with any consistency, and I've said this since Salazar broke into the league. You know, electric fastball, split change is really, really good a lot of the time, but I believe in the American League you've got to have a third pitch if you're going to be a successful starting pitcher. He's gotten away with it largely to this point, but when you see when the fastball command disappears or, you know, leaves you a little bit and the changeup isn't a money pitch for you, you've got to have something else to fall back on, and right now he doesn't. So you got a guy who's searching. And obviously it hits his confidence. You know, I don't think he's going out there with a whole lot of confidence. That's no secret.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Now the second part of that is if he doesn't get this back, and I mean in relatively short order since there's only 5 weeks of baseball left, what are the options for Terry Francona?
Great question. Mike Clevenger is kind of, you know, he's sort of become Danny Salazar's bailout because two starts ago, Clevenger came in through four innings after Salazar had only gone one, and then Kyle Crockett went one, and Clevenger went four. Last night, Clevenger came in a Salazar start. So it's like they're kind of keeping Clevenger as a hedge in case Salazar falls on his face. And that's, you know, that's not a good formula.
Right.
But you would think if Salazar struggles again on Sunday in Texas, which, by the way, is no place to get right, okay?
Amen to that.
Yeah, that's not a place to go where you suddenly find yourself and find your confidence against the Rangers in Globe Life. So I'm not holding out much hope for him on that one. But if he's bad enough, I guess he gets subbed out and Clevenger replaces him. They really don't have anybody else that, you know, you can plug in there to be a starter. So they need Salazar to figure it out if they want to fend off the Tigers and the Royals, because, Bob, I believe this will be a three-team race in September. I do. And I know my people in Cleveland are, you're negative, negative, negative. They have a nice week. I have too much respect for the Tigers and the Royals. I think it will be a three-team race, and it's going to be decided in that final week for Cleveland when they have to go to Comerica for four and Kauffman for three.
Yeah, and you know, when you say that there really isn't an alternative, this is the concern. Jim Cushman and I were talking about this before. If the playoffs were to start right now, who would be the rotation? What would be the rotation? And in a five-game series, I think certainly Kluber, Carrasco, Bauer could get you by. But in a seven-game series, you're going to need that next guy. Is it Tomlin, who's just been getting lit up and has given up, what, 32 long balls, I think, thus far this season? Or is it, yeah, you know, Salazar in the state that he's in? It can't be. So, you know, they've got to figure this out over 5 weeks, you know, because the playoffs are going to start. And you say this is going to be a three-team race. I don't have any reason to doubt that. We just saw it get one game closer for everybody last night as the Royals won their ninth in a row and the Tigers won as well. But assuming they do survive the three-team race and go to the playoffs, if they had to get into a seven-game series, what do you think Tito would do for that fourth spot?
Well, I think they hope that Salazar can figure this out by then. You know, that's the hope. Salazar would get the call. Well, let's put it this way. Whoever's pitching better amongst Tomlin or Salazar would get the call. But the hope is it would be Salazar because he has the power arm, because he has the ability to dominate if he's right, more so than Tomlin does. You know, and that's, you know, his kind of stuff when he's right presumably is going to play better in the playoffs, especially than Tomlin's would. So that's where the Indians are, I think, hoping that Salazar, he's been through rough patches before the last couple of years. Nothing to this extent, though. But they think, okay, if he can just, you know, settle down, get a good start under him, figure out the little mechanical issues that are leading to the command problems, that he'll be the guy they can lean on again.
Dennis Mantiloff joining us, talking about the American League Central race. What are the Royals doing other than just what the Royals do? You know, we saw the Tigers have a hot streak. They won eight in a row. Jim wasn't at eight. Didn't he cap out at eight a couple of weeks back?
Yes.
They won eight in a row and then fell off and then had a bunch of losses and played and ended up playing roughly 500 balls since that point. And they fell. I think they rose to as close to two or two and a half.
Two
within the Indians. And then quickly it fell back to what it was going into yesterday, 7.5. The Royals were down 11 as little as 2.5 weeks ago. Or no, 12, correction, 12 games out in the division. Now they are within 7.5 and they have won nine in a row. Is this the same kind of thing that Detroit did? Just a hot streak for the Royals, who do not have what it takes to keep this kind of pace up for the final 5 weeks and win this division? Or are they different because they've been there the last 2 years, they've done it before, and obviously they are the defending world champions?
The latter. This team is going to be heard from at the end. And I do still think the Tigers will be heard from, too, as I said. I mean, I don't think they're going to peter out either. But the Royals are just, you know, it's the Royals' way, like you said. I mean, they've got pedigree. You know, now they won the last World Series. They've been to the last two. You can't kill them. They got the praying mantis and all that stuff. But look, their defense, they play good defense. They pitch, they run. You know, they single you to death. It's the Royal way, and they finally feel like they're as whole as they can be, obviously without Moustakas, who's a big piece. But they got Kane back, and they're just, you know, they're into that rhythm now, and who can blame them for feeling supremely confident because of what they've accomplished the past couple of years? That's what the benefit it really is. That's where it shows up, is now, because the Royals say, shoot, you know, 7.5 games, that's nothing. We could run these guys down. Well, I mean, I'm sure they don't say it's nothing. But, you know, they look at it and say, okay, it's a steep hill, but we can climb it. And even if we don't climb the division hill, we're right there for the wild card. And do you want to face us in the wild card? No, I don't think you want to face the Royals in the wild card.
No,
you don't want the Royals to get in, period.
And exactly. I wouldn't want them in a first-round five-game series either. I told Jim that yesterday. I mean, they're just, you know, because of what their recent history has been, it's a very scary thing. I promise you in Boston, I promise you in Baltimore, Toronto, Texas, any of these teams that could face the Royals, they don't want anything to do with it. Even though the Indians have been, without question, the class of the division from April to now, I mean, overall, they have spent more time in first place than anybody else by a lot. I promise you, I think they'd rather face the Indians than the Royals because this is, as you say, Dennis, the Royal way. Dennis Manilov is our guest, and Jim Cushlin, Bob France, talking American League Central race right now. Cush, go ahead.
And, you know, I tend to agree with that about not wanting to face the Royals, though I think at this rate they're still looking more at the wild card or would have to than the division. But you guys could be very well right. It could be a couple games when we get some numbers. Still plenty of baseball. But still thinking about that rotation in the playoffs question, because I kind of agree with what you said, Dennis, about how they would handle a best-of-seven LCS or a World Series. They'd go with whoever's pitching better. If we're still kind of having this issue with Salazar and or Tomlin when it gets down to it, do you see them maybe going for a three-man rotation in the best-of-five first-round division series with Kluber, Carrasco, and Bauer, and that would be it? Would that be something they might consider?
Well, sure. In the five-gamer, yes. In the seven-gamer, it's a little trickier. But, again, I'm guessing – I can't read the minds of the front office or Terry Francona or Mickey Callaway, the pitching coach. But I'm guessing that they think that they have enough time here for Salazar to sort himself out and to get right. And therefore, they won't have to worry about the one-fifth of the rotation like they are now with him and then two-fifths with Tomlin. They think that Salazar can get it right. I believe, my gut tells me that they want Salazar to convince himself that he's healthy, to convince himself that his arm is okay, that there's nothing to worry about if he feels a little discomfort. That's just part of pitching. They need him to get that out of his either conscious mind or subconscious mind. And once he feels healthy, he can start turning it loose and he can start committing to his pitches and finishing his pitches. And that'll lead to the command coming back. So I do think they think there's enough time here for Salazar to get right.
Dennis Manilov joining us as we talk a little American League Central baseball. The race got a little tighter last night with the Indians lost. The Tigers win. The Royals win. I want to shift gears, if I can, just for a moment, Dennis, to the Browns, since you do indeed cover them as well as your quarterback breakdown and more. Josh Gordon yesterday, talk of the league. Teams were burning up the phone lines trying to find out from the Browns if they could trade for Josh Gordon. What I want to know is, do you think the Browns would consider doing so? And second of all, do you think that those phone calls actually happen? Pro Football Talk is suggesting that the Browns planted that story in order to drum up interest in him as a possible trading target so that they don't have to make a decision on him going into next season as a restricted free agent, matching offer sheets for a guy who might be pro bowler or an all pro, or who might be, you know, one bad decision away from being banned from the league again.
Nothing would surprise me, Bob. No scenario would surprise me. No scenario of which I would say, yeah, anything's possible regarding Gordon, all right? I wouldn't blame the Browns for being skeptical, about Gordon's future and worrying that he might not be 100% reliable, I wouldn't blame the Browns for going the other way and saying, you know, no matter how many times you call us, we're going to hang up the phone because we really like the potential for Josh Gordon, and we've put in the time with him, and we've waited for the day when Josh Gordon will return. And, you know, so we want the payoff. So I don't blame the Browns, no matter what scenario is painted, whether they conjured the interest, created, manufactured it, or whether it's completely false and they love Gordon and they want to, you know, see him play well for them. Anything to me is on the table where Gordon's concerned.
What would you do? If you were the Browns, what would you do? Would you just kind of ride it out, see how he plays, see if he keeps himself clean, see if he can stay on the field for 12 games? He's got to miss the first four. And then if he does, would you start looking at him next year as a restricted free agent and start talking about a long-term extension? Or would you be interested, like you said, anything is on the table, that if somebody comes calling saying, you know what, yeah, let's put this in somebody else's hands if they give us a high enough pick?
Yeah, short of an outrageous offer, you know, some ridiculously high pick, and I don't even know what that threshold is, but short of an offer that would blow the Browns away, I'm going to stick with what I said a long time ago, and at the time that I said it, it was unpopular. You ride this Gordon thing out. See if you can get something out of all of the issues that surrounded this guy and the suspensions and all the lost time. As long as you still got him to this point, you might as well see, can we get a return on our investment? And I get all the restricted free agent stuff. I get the future and all that. What do you do? But for now, out of fairness to Hugh Jackson, let Hugh Jackson potentially have this weapon. Because the reports you're hearing are that he looks as good as new, okay? He doesn't look like he missed a beat when he's been running around in practice. So out of fairness to Hugh Jackson, give him a chance to, you know, dare I say win games.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Succeed, be competitive. How about that? You know, short of guaranteeing wins, give him a chance to be competitive with a group that could include Josh Gordon. Because here's the thing about the Browns. Yes, they're rebuilding. Yes, they're in the early stages of the rebuild. We all get that. You know, nobody's projecting them to do a whole lot. But you can see pieces on offense that make you go, okay. You know, Griffin, can he recapture? You've got Gordon. You've got Coleman, who's just running past people. You have Pryor. You have Duke Johnson. You have Crow. You have Farnage. So at least on the offensive side, you can see something and go, all right, maybe this team can score some points. You know, the defense doesn't look great, granted. But as part of that offense, I'd hate to see them just say, well, you know what, because Josh Gordon is probably not going to be in our plans for 2 years from now, let's dump him now. I'd like to see them ride it out with them this year and see what they can get.
That sounds like fair enough to me. Good stuff, D-Man. Sorry we didn't have more time, but we appreciate the time you were able to put in. Let's see if the Indians can get a win out in Oakland and take 2 of 3 there and extend that lead back out, depending on what the Tigers and Royals do, of course. And obviously, we'll check in with back in with you real soon.
Thanks, guys. Off to the DBR.
You got it. Put that time in. That's right. You're going to wear out that that button, no doubt about it, on your remote. All right, there's Dennis Mandaloff talking a little American League Central, then a little bit about the NFL trade rumors involving Josh Gordon. Hey, before we take you to SportsCenter here at the top of the hour, let me remind you about the Buckeye Store and More, the college and pro superstore. You know college football season is right around the corner when you start hearing about the Buckeye Store and More. The preseason sale is off and running, 10% store-wide savings with hundreds of new Nike products in stock. For Ohio State, Michigan, and guess what? All of the fan zones are covered. Notre Dame, Michigan State, Toledo, Bowling Green, and the Detroit Tigers as well. That's right. And take advantage of the doorbuster sales as well. 50 to 75% off every day on hundreds of items. Just get into the store early. The Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore, is in Sylvania, Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe. Look for Big Brutus on the Roof, right between Ralphie's and Dave's in front of Prometica. By the way, get Big Brutus for your front yard as well. That's another one of the outstanding items available at the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro.
Strike one, line drive, base hit into center. J.D. Martinez in. Right behind him, Justin Upton, third of the plate, will be cut off. He will score. Maven's trapped between first and second. He'll be caught in the rundown eventually. Two-run score, and the Tigers take a two-run lead. 2-1, swinging a fly ball, right field off the bat of Eric Ibar, way back in right, and
wow,
gone. How about that? Swings and drives this one to right field. Oh, man, was it fly? Gone. Victor Martinez with an absolute no-doubter to right. Tigers are having some fun. Ground ball to short. Ibar charges. Fields throws on the run to get Max Kepler easily at first. Another good inning for Kyle Ryan, and the Tigers take the opener here in Minneapolis.
I think I still leaving the ball up. That's what happened tonight, but that doesn't mean to stop me. I just gotta keep working, and I know I could have done. I don't know, but I'll try to get it as soon as I can, you know. I'm working. I'm gonna keep working every day, every single day. It is tough, you know, like right now we're trying to win. And like I said, we just can't let that get into our minds, you know, and just go out there and attack like we always do.
With too many fastballs, you know, because of that, it didn't seem like they really had to respect his off-speed pitches. So they got pretty good swings his fastball. You know, the hope is that he gets some repetition, you know, including side days and stuff, and you know, gets back to the Danny that we saw in the first half, because it'll certainly be helpful.
Six Notre Dame players were arrested in two separate incidents. South Bend officers arrested cornerback Devin Butler outside of a bar. After shoving a woman, he allegedly tackled an officer and was arrested. And in another incident, five Notre Dame players were pulled over with marijuana and a loaded handgun in the car. The University of Notre Dame issued a statement this morning saying, quote, any student arrested on a felony charge also faces dismissal from the university. The university will determine if additional sanctions should apply to any or all of the students charged.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed, an hour number two is underway at 11 minutes past. Thanks so much for joining us on the Extravaganza. Jim, what did you say that Indian score was? Already down 2-0?
Yeah, already down 2-0. A couple of run scoring singles. Still men on the corners, only one out. So a bad second inning for Trevor Bauer.
Cheers all around from Detroit, from part of Toledo. Mudhens / Tigers fans loving life as they hope to have this thing down to 6 by the time they take the field tonight against the Minnesota Twins once again. So just a very interesting development there. More interesting, and for obviously very, very bad reasons, is the situation with Notre Dame football right now. Brian Kelly, the head coach at Notre Dame, made a very, very strong statement and made some very, very strong decisions in reaction to the arrest of several players in two separate incidents that you already heard from. Max Redfield, the starting strong safety for the Irish going into the season, dismissed from the football team. Devin Butler on an indefinite suspension. Other players going to be disciplined within the football program. And the statement made by Brian Kelly was one that I really, really respect, and that was one of complete accountability for those players. Rather than looking for excuses, why did the police pick on them the way that Nick Saban did in a somewhat similar situation not too long ago regarding some Alabama football players, but holding the players accountable. That, to me, is a very, very strong statement by Brian Kelly. How does the rest of the country look at Notre Dame football in the wake of all of this, though? That's something we're going to discuss right now with Brendan Riley, who writes for and edits the Notre Dame sports website, 18stripes.com. Joins us now on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. Once again, Brendan, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time with us. How are you?
Good, Bob. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Brendan. Let's talk. Oh, geez, Jim, 3-0 now? 3-0.
That was a sack fly. Now there are two outs, but ugh.
Oh, my goodness. They're going to have to break out the whooping sticks. Was that, Brendan?
just stop watching it.
Yeah, no question about it. I'm actually not watching it because I don't have a screen with an eye shot of where I am in the studio. Jim Cushlin keeps updating me. It's 3-0.
Yeah.
That's not a good thing. Jim and I are both Cleveland natives, so we're Indians fans. A lot of our listeners are Tigers fans, so we have an interesting thing going on here.
Nice.
Okay, so Brennan, your reaction, your first reaction when you heard about what happened over the weekend, the arrest of these players, particularly the one involving guns, or at least a gun, and marijuana, and Max Redfield, who is expected to be a starter, the only one I think who is supposed to be, who will not be able to do so because he's not on the team. Your reaction to Brian Kelly's decision here?
Well, to the events was a lot of disappointment, especially with Redfield. You know, there was discussion that he had dealt with some of his maturity issues and then turned the corner, you know, in the summer, in the fall camp, and then to see something like this happen, you just kind of shake your head. The way Kelly responded to it, I like a lot about it. I like that he responded quickly. I think what the dismissal of Redfield, he sent a big message to the rest of the team that we expect accountability for your actions. You know, the fact that the other four guys are younger, they're still with the team, you know, pending whatever internal discipline happens. But Redfield being the senior, more was expected of him. And Kelly obviously put his foot down and said, you know, the rest of you need to understand that this isn't acceptable. At the same time, I think he also guarded against going too harsh in the initial response and saying that, you know, for now, these players will face internal discipline. As we learn more about the case, more stuff is possible. So there's a little bit of a balance of that kind of parental approach, right, where you force accountability, but you also are looking out for the best interest of them overall.
So from a legal perspective, though, all of the passengers involved in the incident involving speeding, at 73 and a 60 is not bad, by the way. I do that all the time, especially on the turnpike between Cleveland and Toledo.
Should have been doing 72.
Yeah. What's that?
Should have been doing 72.
Yeah, I generally try to keep it at 10. I usually try not to go more than 10 over. If you're in a 60 or a 65 zone or on the turnpike in a 70 zone, you'd only want to go more than 5 over that, maybe 72 or 3 in a 70. But anyway, they have that. Then they have the taillight. They get stopped, and that's when the cops smell the weed, and then they find the loaded handgun.
Right.
So all of them, from a legal standpoint, are facing the same thing. They all face Redfield, Stepherson, and Williams all face gun charges. So you're saying that the difference between them and Redfield in this case is Redfield's history, from the program standpoint, is Redfield's history as well as the fact that he's a senior, and you expect more from a senior, a 22-year-old, than you do, you know, 18, 19-year-old kids who are in their freshman seasons.
Right. I mean, you know, he got sent home from the bowl game, you know, before the game. We don't know exactly why, you know, details never got out about that, but obviously, that was a big deal. That was a big impact to the team. There's lots of rumors floating around among the fan base, of course, but there's been stuff throughout his career where maybe he wasn't always the easiest guy to coach, and the coaches had to do a lot to light a fire under him or to get him to focus or whatever. So, you know, you just see a string of events, and I think this thing was kind of the capper. Here you have a guy going into his final season. He's supposed to be a leader on the defense. He's out with a bunch of underclassmen on possibly a late-night weed run with a gun in the car. It's just like, come on, man. You got to be smarter than that, you know.
Yeah, no question about it. And I mentioned freshmen. Yep. Two of them were freshmen. The other two were sophomores, right?
Yes,
and they, according to Brian Kelly, are just going to be dealt with internally from, as I think you described it, as a parenting kind of a thing. He's going to keep them on board, but he's going to discipline them as maybe a heavy-handed father would, but he's not going to cut them loose.
Right. Yeah. That's what he said, and that's also backed up by, you know, what you kind of read in the rumor webs right now. In fact,
are you okay with are you okay with them staying on board, especially the sophomores? The freshmen, you know, it's weird because we're differentiating between a senior and the freshman, which I totally get. Sophomores have been in the program for a year. They know what to expect from Coach Kelly. They know what their expectations are from the program, from the university, et cetera, especially being a Catholic institution. They take their reputation as having not just great players, but good character individuals who are also good students. You don't get into Notre Dame, no matter how fast you run the 40 or how many times you can bench 225, unless you're a good student as well. When you have those expectations and you know them, you were a year into the program as a sophomore, I don't know, I kind of feel like that maybe they should be held to a higher standard than even the freshmen who just kind of are getting their feet wet.
I think it's a fair point, you know, especially you consider the freshmen, you know, they came into fall camp, but really they've been there for 2 months, you know, and haven't, I don't think they've really spent all that much time on campus, maybe half that time, you know, the other half, there's an off-campus camp, basically. So they haven't really gotten into campus life at all. So I think that's a valid point. I think a lot of it, I would imagine, without knowing the specifics of each of these guys' histories on campus, probably depends a lot on the other, their other actions in their time there. You know, Ashton White and Tevin Coney are the sophomores. And Dexter Williams. So if, you know, they've been good guys in the rest of their time on campus, they probably get a little more leeway. I would imagine, you know, that there is some kind of scale where they'll get more internal discipline than the young guys. But I understand your point, and I agree with you, actually, you know, that you'd expect the sophomores also to take a little more sensible role there.
Is discipline, we're talking with Brendan Riley, who writes for 18stripes.com, mm-hmm. which is a Notre Dame football and Notre Dame sports website. 18stripes.com, check it out. It's a great site, branched off from an SB Nation site into their own into their own vehicle here, and it's terrific. Is discipline at Notre Dame solely up to Coach Kelly, or is there anything above him, from the athletic director, from the president of the university, from a board of trustees? Is there anybody else who has a say here as to whether or not these guys get to stay on the team or face something more than what Coach Kelly wants to do?
So as far as the formal process, Kelly decides from the team standpoint. The university decides from academic and, you know, enrollment standpoint. And the university can say this person's not allowed to participate in sports, right? But barring that, whatever team discipline Kelly wants to distribute is up to him, whether it's dismissal. Now, that's the formal process. I'm sure in reality, you know, there's quite a bit of discussion between him, the athletic director, Jack Swarbrick, the president of the university, Father Jenkins. I think those three work together very well. And I'm sure when something comes up like this, there's some kind of conference room session between the three of them where they hash it out.
Are you an alum, by the way, Brendan?
I am, yes.
Okay. I ask only because I'm wondering, do you believe, since you were on campus for 4 years at least, I'm sure, I didn't mean that in a bad way, like it took you 5 years. I don't know if you graduate school or anything else.
It's the best 7 years of my life, yeah.
Did you really? So you have advanced degrees from Notre Dame?
No. I was making jokes.
Oh, you were doing the Animal House thing. Okay, great.
Yeah.
would a student who is not an athlete, particularly a football player, and as great as Notre Dame basketball can be and has been, and women's basketball and all the rest, football mm-hmm. is still football. Football is still king on the campus there.
Right.
There's touchdown Jesus. There's not slam dunk Jesus anywhere, as far as I know.
Right,
if you're not a Notre Dame football player and you are arrested with weed and firearms illegally, illegal possession of firearm, I'm assuming that none of these guys were concealed carry permit holders, and this was a legally carried weapon. You are not a football player and you have weed and a gun and you're arrested, are you going to be allowed to remain at Notre Dame? Or could they just say, we don't want you on our campus anymore? Do you think that would happen?
I've heard, we'll set the gun aside as a separate thing, because I haven't heard too much about gun possession, or really anything.
Do we know whose it was yet? Did they determine who owned it? Did anybody step up and say
There are various rumors floating around that probably wouldn't be responsible of me to share, because I can't substantiate them to any degree.
Okay, fair enough. I just didn't know if I'd missed that in the media as I try to follow this if they had decided whose gun it was. Somebody's going to have to take ownership of that, unless they're all just going to fall on their own swords, so to speak.
I believe it was borrowed.
I'm sorry?
I believe it was borrowed.
It was borrowed or stolen, but whatever. Who claimed stolen, ownership of it at that night, I mean? Who obtained it and brought it with them?
Yeah, I don't know.
Unless they're all going to say shared responsibility, we all agreed, or if one of them, maybe the others didn't even know he had it tucked away in his waistband or his back pocket or wherever it was.
Right.
And you know what I mean? That's the reason I ask, because I think that the culpability here from a school disciplinary standpoint, from a football program disciplinary standpoint, and from a legal or judicial situation, I have to believe that in a criminal justice system situation, I have to believe that they're going to want to identify who it belonged to, unless they're all going to say,
absolutely,
that was all of ours. I can't see that happening.
I think from a, and I'm not a lawyer, right, but from a legal standpoint for the guys in the car, assuming it wasn't licensed, which it probably wasn't,
right.
I don't think it's too different whether it was theirs or somebody else's, unless it was stolen, obviously. From a university standpoint, if it belonged to someone who wasn't in the car, I would imagine a student who wasn't in the car, I would imagine that that student would also be in deep trouble with the university.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah.
Unless of course that student it was licensed to and it was stolen from him.
Yeah.
Which we don't know. But I'm a little interested in the legal part, and you're not a lawyer, neither am I, so maybe we should just kind of table this discussion, but I kind of feel like it should matter whose it was, because again, there were five of them, right? Five of them in one car.
Right.
By the way, how do five Notre Dame football players fit in a Ford Focus?
I'd like to know that, right?
It's a Ford Focus.
I don't know.
It's not exactly a big sedan.
Everybody exhale.
But, yeah, exactly.
Well, they put the linebacker in the front seat, right? That was a good idea.
But again, yeah. I, not being a lawyer either, I feel like if I had gotten into that car with my boys, and even if one of them had weed and maybe they all shared the weed, I don't know. They don't all necessarily know if somebody has stuck a gun in their pocket. And until if they're going to suspend or expel from Notre Dame anybody based upon that gun, I got to be thinking that if I'm one of the kids or if I'm the lawyer representing one of the kids, I want to know, did you know that they had that your teammate had this, and were you okay with it? And if you didn't know, we need to tell them that you can't be held responsible for firearm possession when you had no idea that a firearm was being possessed in your vehicle.
Right.
Or in the vehicle you were riding in as a passenger.
Right. It's definitely an interesting dynamic here, too, is how strong are the bonds of brotherhood, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Are they going to go down together and say, hey, you know what, let's not make this hard on any one of us, let's all split it, or are they going to is somebody going to own up? But anyway, you said a second ago, putting the gun aside, just to the point of having the weed in the car, would a non-football player be expelled from the school for such an offense?
I don't think expelled. I would say that when I was there in the 90s, I think things were harsher, and we'll set aside whether or not they should have been. But back then, I don't think there would have been much of a question. I think you probably would have been gone, regardless, football player or non. I think you mentioned Kyle McElhorney.
Maybe you didn't.
But Kyle McElhorney is a basketball player.
I did not mention that.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. So he was, I think, early, mid-2000s. He had a joint or something, and he was suspended for a year from the school. And I think we've softened since then, from what I can understand. I think football player or no, there would be some consequences. I think on campus or off campus matters to some degree. I think I've heard of students having it in their rooms and facing stiffer penalties. So, you know, there's kind of a, yeah, we understand stuff happens, but don't bring it on campus kind of element. But I'm not going to guarantee that a football player would get exactly the same discipline for a number of reasons, but it would be pretty close, I think.
You know, Brendan, what interests me here, Brendan Riley is our guest. Brendan is writes and edits for the website 18stripes.com, dedicated to Notre Dame football and Notre Dame sports. What's interesting to me is typically you think, you know, that football players who are very important to the university get the benefit of the doubt. They get the break, like they're doing down there in Alabama for the most part.
Right.
But for Notre Dame, which strikes me from what we know about Notre Dame, and this is a compliment, not a criticism, about protecting, you know, kind of like the NFL with protecting the shield. Notre Dame mantra is about having good quality character people, not just great players.
Right.
And I'm looking at the mugshots of six guys right now, five in the one car, and then, of course, Devin Butler, who has been suspended indefinitely. I'm looking at all six of the mugshots, and on four of the six, I see their Notre Dame T-shirts.
Yes, I noticed that too.
That's what they're wearing as they get photographed for their criminal mugshots. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm Notre Dame, if I'm the president, Father, what's his name, Jenkins?
Father Jenkins, yeah.
Father Jenkins. This is my university, and all of these guys being arrested are wearing Notre Dame football shirts. It doesn't look good. It doesn't sit well. It violates, it stains or tarnishes the quote-unquote shield of Notre Dame, as I compared it to the NFL. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like they'd almost want to hold these guys to a higher standard because they represent the University of Notre Dame to the rest of the world. In the same way you said you'd hold a senior to a higher standard than a freshman, I think you'll hold the athletes to a higher standard than the rest of the students because they are so high profile.
Yeah.
That's a reasonable point again. You agree with that?
No. I'm processing a reasonable point again.
Okay.
I think, you know, it's a complicated question, right? Because there's a lot of reasons why, and I'm certainly not going to go down the path of rationalizing, you know, lesser penalties for them or anything like that. But I think there's a holistic view to each case. And I think especially over the last several years, university's gotten better at that, for each student. And a student athlete slash student. And, you know, a lot of these guys, let's say come from different circumstances than a lot of the regular students, right? And maybe there's some acknowledgement that, okay, you may have seen that at home. We're not going to do that here. You made a mistake. Let's move forward from this. You know, we get a lot of kids from, bad areas, bad situations. They, you know, Lewis Nix talked about how he had to get to the NFL so he could make money to move his family out of where they were living in Jacksonville, right? So maybe there's some allowance there with, okay, we understand, again, that in the past you've seen this. Let's talk about how to fix it going forward. You know, and I think the big element for them is how does the player approach it? How does the player take accountability? And how committed are they to cleaning up their act, right? And we've seen some players over the past several years, and again, this is all rumored stuff on message boards, so I'm not going to mention names, but guys that have left the university on their own after certain things similar to this, not with a gun, but similar to this have been rumored. And, you know, the assumption there is that whatever was laid out for them as the plan to, you know, recover from that mistake, they weren't on board with and they moved on, you know. So I think it's a little different for each player depending on the context of the situation.
Sure, sure. And I understand that, and I'm okay with that. Yep. Let me move on to the last thing, and that is Butler. Yeah. Butler's incident was arguably worse than the others. The others were speeding, they had weed, and they had a gun, which is all really, really bad when you add them all up.
Yeah.
No question about that. But none of them committed an assault. None of them were arrested for a violent crime. Devin Butler, a senior, is arrested outside of the linebacker bar off campus, involved in a fight in the bar, and then attacks a police officer, or at least fights with a police officer, even if they don't want to term it an attack. Resisting arrest and scuffling with the police officer is obviously a very, very bad thing. We're talking about a couple of different violent episodes here with him. Why do you suppose it is Brian Kelly, whom I praised, by the way, for his strong language of accountability here, particularly in comparison to Nick Saban, why do you suppose he only went with the indefinite suspension for Butler when he went for the, and I think we probably covered Redfield enough because of his previous incidents and whatever his record was, but why do you suppose he wasn't booted from the team for something that is far worse, I think, than just getting arrested with the and I want to say just, that minimizes it, but for getting arrested with the weed and the gun in the case of the five players.
I think my guess from what I've read of the situation is that the dismissal is forthcoming. I think in this case, I'm going to guess that Redfield and the guys in the car, they didn't dispute the version of events that was in the police report. I think Butler might have had a little different story. When he talked to Kelly, and Kelly probably said, okay, let's see what plays out. In the meantime,
Being thorough and cautious and doing his due diligence before he makes
any. I think so. I mean, the you know, Redfield's out of the picture completely. The other four guys from the car are practicing right now. Butler is not. Butler is not around the team right now.
Okay, well, I wouldn't expect so with you know, indefinite suspension in place here.
So,
and maybe, like you said, maybe a dismissal coming. Any word from the university as to what timetable they're working on with investigating that and making a decision?
No, I mean, I think it depends somewhat on the legal proceedings. I know the prosecutor, I think just yesterday, announced that they're going ahead with the felony charges against him, so that's obviously a very bad sign. After reviewing the police report and talking to the officers. So, that, you know, there was some, I don't know if hope is the right word, some thought among the fan base that, you know, with this disputed story that maybe the prosecutor would review it and drop the charges down, but that didn't happen. So, you know, it is as serious as it initially seemed. So it's not looking good for Butler right now.
What was Butler's role on the football team going into the season? We knew Redfield was going to be a starter at safety,
yeah,
but where was Butler?
He was a reserve corner. He broke his foot in the summer. He was not expected back until probably November. So it wasn't going to be, you know, he wasn't a significant contributor probably. He's a good guy to have. You know, he's a senior, but not necessarily a huge loss to the depth chart.
For on-field football purposes, which is why most Notre Dame fans listen to the radio and watch video like this, it's
right.
The real impact here is going to be with Redfield. The sophomores and the freshmen were not going to be probable contributors anyway, and Butler was a reserve anyway.
I think Coney actually would have been in a Tevin Coney would have been in a rotation at will.
Okay. So that is a loss from an on-field standpoint.
Yeah.
By the way, again, we're talking to Brendan Riley, really kind with his time, and we appreciate it, Brendan. You said the other four guys from the car are practicing. Do you know what their in-house suspension, or I'm sorry, what their in-house discipline is or was? Are they just running extra, or is that still being sorted out? I'm just surprised to hear that a couple of days after all this goes down that they're actually on the practice field.
I don't know. I haven't seen anything firm. I know from being there, I actually had a minor run-in with our student affairs office myself, right? And many people that I knew did. like I said, the office was stricter back in the day. But, you know, a favorite penalty for anyone who runs a foul like that is community service. So, and generally pretty substantial
amounts.
That's
from the university, right? That's the university. That's theirs.
That's the university and the
team. The football program might be different because Kelly's statement said, quote, while not being separated from the team, they will be subject to disciplinary measures internal to the football program. So that's a little different than what you're talking about with community service or anything else.
That happens with the sports programs too. Yeah.
Okay. So there may be something within the university itself, and then also separate a punishment from or a disciplinary measurement, they're calling it, from the football program. Okay. Well, we're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. It's really a disappointing thing. Like I said, I know the university takes their reputation very seriously as a Catholic university. Mm-hmm. You know, they stand for something different. And it's not just, hey, we'll take anybody who can run a 4.4. We want somebody who can run a 4.4 and actually get a 4.0, and we want character people here. And this kind of thing certainly doesn't do much for that reputation. So.
All right.
Hey, Brendan, thanks for the talk. A great conversation. Keep up the great work on the website.
Likewise.
We'll continue to send people to it. It's 18stripes.com, dedicated to Notre Dame football, basketball, lacrosse, and Notre Dame sports. Brendan, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob. Take care.
You got it. Have a good one. All right, there you go. That's Brendan Riley from 18stripes.com. I said it's all Notre Dame sports, but as I was browsing a little bit during our conversation, I looked at their archives, and they got football, basketball, and lacrosse. Maybe they're adding more. I don't know. But I don't see anything about women's basketball there, so or volleyball or anything else for that matter. So 18 stripes is certainly named for the football program, the 9 stripes in each end zone at Notre Dame. All right, good stuff. We're going to take a timeout here. On the way into the timeout, though, you know what I want to do? I want to hook you up with more baseball tickets. Mud Hens, Clippers, Friday. All right, just 2 days away on the 26th at Fifth Third Field. I got a pair for you right now. If you are the 10th caller to 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, we'll send you to the Clippers against the Mud Hens at Fifth Third Field. And we'll get to your phone calls on the other side of this timeout now. SportsCenter time on ESPN 106.5. Yon.
Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Extended drum solo intro as we roll on the extravaganza. I got you about another 16. We'll get Mike Miller and Drive Time coming your way right at 5 o'clock. We're technically about 5:05 after the top of the hour Sports Center. Hey, want to remind you, college football is almost here. You know that from the conversation we just had about Notre Dame. Notre Dame is one of the fan zones that you can find inside the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Oh, my goodness gracious. The Fighting Irish fan zone, the Spartans fan zone, the Rockets, the Falcons, the Tigers, and, of course, Michigan and the namesake for the store, the Ohio State Buckeyes, the Buckeye Store and more. All of your college football and college sports needs available for you right there. The preseason sale is off and running. 10% store-wide savings on everything in the store right now. Hundreds of new Nike products are in stock. And if you get in early, take advantage of the doorbuster sales, 50 to 75% off every day at the Buckeye Store and More in Sylvania, Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe. You'll find it right between Ralphie's and Dave's and in front of Prometica. Look for Big Brutus on the Roof, and he, by the way, is available for purchase and delivery. All you got to do is inquire at the Buckeye Store and More, Starlight Plaza in Sylvania, 5700 Monroe. The Buckeye Store and More is the college and pro superstore. All right, a really interesting conversation with Brendan Riley of 18stripes.com talking about the Notre Dame football fiasco of six players involved in separate incidents, well, five in one and one in another, but two separate incidents involving six players getting arrested, one booted, one suspended indefinitely as of now, and the other four, I guess the discipline is going to be determined by the football program and the university. First of all, congratulations to Carl Rouse of Grand Rapids. He is the latest winner of the Mud Hens and Clippers tickets for this Friday at Fifth Third Field. Enjoy the game. We'll have another pair to give away on tomorrow's extravaganza, so make sure you're listening for that. And speaking of baseball, Jim Cushlin says to me immediately after the Sports Center he just did, Bob, did you see that inning? And I said, no, you know I don't have a screen in front of me in my part of the studio. What happened in the inning? You got to let me tell you on the air. All right, Jim, you're on the air. What happened in the Indians and A's game out there in Oakland?
Okay, let's see. It starts, it's all in the second inning, by the way. It starts with Chris Davis. You know, that for those who stayed up late, the guy who blasted one to start Salazar's night off horribly, quite possibly the one Oakland A having a good season.
Yeah, he's got, what, 33 home runs or something like that?
33 bombs after that one yesterday. Well, he leads off with a triple.
All right.
Bauer walks the next guy. I suppose that's expected. We all know Bauer walks the people.
Yep.
Then you get an RBI single. Then a ground out, then another RBI single, then a sac fly, so it's now 3-0. You get another single.
So hold on, you've already lost me a little bit. So we get triple, ground out,
triple,
RBI single.
Triple walk.
RBI single.
RBI single.
Ground out.
Another RBI single.
Sacrifice fly.
Okay, so now there are two outs, but three runs.
3-0, two down.
Right. Three runs are already in, two down.
Bases empty?
No, there were a couple of guys on still. Okay. In fact, they were on second and third.
All right.
Pop up. Oh, should get him out of the inning. Oh, no. Carlos Santana loses it in the sun. Two more runs score.
What?
Yep.
What do you mean by pop up? Infield?
It was, yes. It had
to
be less
than
two.
What do you mean Carlos Santana? Carlos Santana's not DHing?
Let me trouble. I think... No, Carlos Santana's at first today. He's at first. Napoli's DHing today.
No.
Yep. And it was
so
two
it's 5-0.
Yes, it's 5-0, and the drop ball being horrible because there were two outs, so no infield fly rule in effect. Because
oh
there were two
goodness.
Outs, and the guys, it's two outs, so they just kind of trot home as the ball is falling down to the ground.
Where did it land? Like in front of first, or
yeah,
where was it?
On the grass in front of first.
Oh my goodness gracious!
Yep.
So Trevor Bauer. Three innings in, six hits, five, looking at the box now,
yep.
Five runs, all of them earned, because
that's
goes
not an
as
error.
A two, that goes as a two-run hit, not an
yes,
error.
Yes, that was not scored an error, because his glove never actually touched
right.
the ball, so they all the runs are earned. So, but he starts by giving up a triple, a couple more hits, and a standard Trevor Bauer walk, but it should only be 3-0, instead it's 5.
Yeah, and
Kendall Graveman has induced about two double play ground balls through four innings already.
Oh, boy. So they got their work cut out for them.
Yes,
obviously,
they do.
It's still, are they through four? Are we going to five now?
One out and bottom of the fourth.
Okay. All right. Well, my goodness gracious. They got their work cut out for them in four more shots up at the dish, or five, I guess it would be.
Yep.
If they just batted in the fourth. Okay. Well, that's bad news for Indians fans. Great news for Tigers fans who are hoping to not, you know, we talked about this yesterday. You know, the Indians had a pretty good little look at the schedule here, 3 in Oakland, a team that is 19 games under 500, a team that is not only playing terrible baseball but is fighting with itself. Two players just got fined for fighting in the clubhouse over endorsement deals.
Not to mention a team the Indians swept pretty easily and handily
yep.
about 3 weeks ago in Cleveland.
You kind of figure they go out there and at the very worst, you just take the series 2 out of 3 and maybe sweep 3 in a row, while the Tigers also have a pretty good look at the schedule here, pretty good break because they have the worst team in the American League or one of the worst in baseball in the Minnesota Twins.
Well, let's put it this way. The Tigers won on the road right now, and then at home over the weekend, they get in a row the two worst teams in the AL, the Twins and Angels.
This is a big, big time right now.
And the Indians will go to Texas after this game today.
This next week is the Tigers' chance to make a move or not. That's it.
Yeah.
Now, we know the Royals are already making their move. They won 9 in a row. But this is what will define whether or not the Tigers are players in this thing in the final month or whether they're pretenders. They're either contenders or pretenders based on what happens in the next, what, 8 games, technically. 2 more with the Twins, yes?
Yeah, tonight and tomorrow with the Twins, and then it's back to Comerica Park for the Angels for the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Who are horrible, and then?
Then they actually stay home for the White Sox Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week before going to Kansas City on Labor Day weekend, which, believe it or not, people, it's already here. So and that's a good point what you're bringing these next 7 or 8 days, because next weekend's Labor Day weekend. That's one of those markers, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, this could not set up better for the Tigers.
Right.
These three teams, Minnesota, the Angels, and then who did the White Sox, I mean, that's about as easy as it gets. If you can't, let's see, on those 9 games.
And they already won yesterday.
What do we think? I know I'm counting it and just saying, what do we think needs to happen here? 6 of 9?
Yeah, minimum, you know, taking, 6 of 9. You got to take two out of three of these guys.
Maybe
yep.
7 of 9 if you can sweep one of them, which at home against the Angels, why couldn't they? Why shouldn't they? So you're looking at potentially 6 out of 9 or 7 out of 9, probably, you know, if they're playing, you know, the way that they can. And the Indians have, now if they lose this one, they're down 5-0 in the bottom of the fourth. They have, Texas coming up after this, which is the leader in the National League, yep, or American League West.
Four gamer, by the way, that starts tomorrow. They don't get an off day because they're going to Central Time, so they don't give them the travel off day this time.
Okay. So if we look at, the Indian schedule, what do they have after Texas?
I'm bringing that back up.
Okay, yeah, I want to know exactly what they have after this now, because when I say the next 8 days, we just kind of lined up counting yesterday, so we'll say 9 days counting yesterday, retroactive. If the Tigers can win 6 out of 9 against 3 terrible teams,
yep,
and the Indians now will possibly, I don't want to say likely, but it is 5-0, likely have lost 2 out of 3 to a terrible team, and now you have Texas, a very good team, but that is also scuffling in its own right, by the way. Texas has lost 3 in a row, for those who are.
Yeah, they're playing the Reds, who, of course, have had a horrid season. And the Reds took the first one yesterday, which is good news. It's part of the reason the Indians come into today, even after the loss, best record in the AL. And now I got the rest of the schedule. So after Texas this weekend, Indians then come home Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
You don't want to say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. The Indian killers themselves.
Yep, the Minnesota Twins.
Ah! See, and again, isn't that ironic? Because we talk about how, boy, it really breaks out nicely for the Tigers. They have the weak Twins here to beat up on. And when the Indians have the Twins to beat up on, you can't say that because they have owned the Indians for the duration.
And then after the Twins, when the calendar flips to September for Labor Day weekend, Labor Day, and the middle of that week after, last games of any kind for the Indians against non-AL Central. They host the Marlins,
Miami Marlins,
who are trying to stay in the NL wildcard, and the Houston Astros for 4, who
also are trying to stay in the playoff
race.
They're
not as good. Despite what the standings say, they don't feel in as good a position to say the Tigers or the Royals, but they're still trying to stay in that, not just West, but
they're
wild card
relevant
as well. So they're still somewhat relevant. And then after that, starting with Friday the 9th, so a couple weeks from now, then it's all Central opponents the rest of the way after that.
Including Twins again, which is not good. Then White Sox, which is a little better for 4.
And those
then
are
the
road.
First 3 against the Tigers.
Yep, and those are home.
Then Royals, White Sox, Tigers again, and finishing with Kansas City.
Yep.
So that's, you know, like I said, I think the Indians would love to have opened up. They had an 8.5 game lead. They would love to have opened that up to a 10 game lead. I still believe if they were able to go into the month of September with a double digit lead, it would all be over but the shouting, and it's just a fight for the wild card behind them. But if they struggle and lose this one again, today, I mean, right now, the one they're losing 5-0. And if this lead, which would drop to 6, drops to 5.5 over the Tigers and potentially just 6.5 over the Royals, I'll tell you what, there ain't nobody behind the Indians who are going to look at them and say,
well, 6.5 right now, so it would drop to 6 if the Indians lose, and then 5.5 if the Tigers then win later tonight.
That's what I said.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly
my bad,
what
I misheard you then.
That's all right. And then 6.5 for the Royals is where it would be if they win tonight.
Correct, yeah.
So I don't think anybody behind the Indians are looking up at them and seeing, man, I need a microscope to see those guys. Or not a microscope, a telescope, wrong kind. I need a telescope to see those guys. They're so far out in front. This can't be done. I think they are absolutely emboldened in saying, let's go run these sons of bees down. We're not just going to worry about the wild card here and fighting with 4 other teams for that. Let's just win the division. Let's just win the division, be a first round, have a divisional series, and not have to worry about any wild card nonsense. And I got to tell you, as confident as it felt just a couple of days ago after another great pitching performance, Corey Kluber, Carlos Carrasco, as confident as that was a couple of days ago, it's really precarious when you get beyond those two starters.
Yeah, and that's
why we talked about the best starting rotation in the American League all season long. We said in April, Jim, and you remember this in the preseason preview shows that we did.
Yep.
That they could potentially have the best starting rotation in the American League and one of the best in baseball. And doggone if it didn't play out that way for the better part of 4 months, the Indians have had the best 1-5 starting rotation in baseball. You solidify the bullpen with Miller, and you really should be just kind of cruising toward a division championship.
Especially with, quite honestly, an offense overall, especially with the outfield issues and Brantley being out. Honestly, for me, Bob, an offense that's played better than I thought they would.
Well, not just better than I thought they would, better than they're capable of.
Yeah.
Truthfully, they're outperforming their own ability. I think they're playing over their head. And the problem is, well, not a problem, it's a good thing. For them, nobody's told them that. Nobody's told them that, hey, you guys are performing. Wait, you guys are putting up more runs per game than you're supposed to. Your team batting average is way higher than it's supposed to. The power you're getting from Napoli and Santana and others is more than they ever thought they were going to get. Nobody really told these guys they're not supposed to be this good offensively. But, Jim, it was built on the rotation. And we just talked with Maniloff about this, that two-fifths of the rotation is in a complete funk in Salazar and Tomlin. But watching Bauer right now, he's kind of a day-to-day. He's a start-to-start guy. He's either going to give you six solid and get a win, or he's going to get blown out a little bit and get blown up. But now you might have severe, bold-faced font question marks over three of the five starters that were, up until this point, the best in the American League.
Well,
only Kluber and Carrasco.
Yeah.
Can you really say, I feel awesome going into this game because that guy's on the hill?
And to sum up from my point of view, you know, your analysis of where you are in the standings and the calendar, and it's going to be a dogfight down to the end. If the Indians want to still try to avoid that, it's, to me, I look at looking at calendar and games ahead and everything,
yeah.
6-2. What do I mean by that? Six, up by six still. Next Friday, September 2nd, which is the Friday of Labor Day weekend, if they could still be six up or more at that point, that gives them the breathing room I think would be necessary, when, especially when they go back into all divisional play starting on the 9th and beyond. But if it's under six, or especially under five, by the time we get to next Friday the 2nd, the Friday of Labor Day weekend, then you blatantly will have that dogfight on your hands.
Yeah, I
six
think
by
exactly,
two is the moniker for me on this one.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's boy, oh boy, did things
and that is 8 days away, by the way.
You know, we kind of said this would be nip and tuck between those three teams going down, and then I kind of backtracked and said the Indians could put it away before September, and now we're back to this. It's just that there are so many of these teams, not so many, we're only talking about three teams, but all three of these teams in contention in the AL Central are team streak. You know, the Tigers have winning streaks and losing streaks. The Indians go on great runs and then long runs of despair. Not long runs, but enough to bring everybody back closer to the pack. And, of course, the Royals are on the streak of all streaks right now. 9 in a row, late August, headed toward the final month of the season. And so here we are. A really, you know, winding road to get here, but we are here in what we thought we would be in. And that is a real nip-and-tuck battle between now and October 1st and playoff time. All right, great stuff, great conversations with Brendan Riley of 18stripes.com and Dennis Maniloff of cleveland.com as well. Really appreciate the conversations with them, and we really appreciate you being a part of the program with us as well. Tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock, the next extravaganza. Stay where you are. Drive Time is coming up next. Mike Miller waiting in the wings right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.